London Calling. David here. We've been doing a lot of Christmas stuff lately, so maybe something a bit different tonight. Maybe a bit of Lit Crit, a bit of Dickens that's not A Christmas Carol or Scrooge or Bob Cratchit. And aside here, one notes that the wretched spell checker knows better than you and turns Bob Cratchit into Bob Crochet. Two fingers to spell checkers. We're now, what, 9 months along, and 2020's Rosemary's Baby, better known as COVID-19, has well and truly come of age. Or think the Ridley Scott film, Alien. It's well and truly out, and around us, and after us, and in amongst us. Replicating itself, really, isn't it? Delivered itself of Tier 4 and, we're told, a new, more contagious strain of the virus. Gone viral. How innocent that phrase used to be. No more. Never again. Anyway, coming up to that time of the year when you look back, take the measure of what the old dying year has served up. Dying year indeed. Even if you steer by hard facts and hard facts only, somehow even those hard facts have taken on a lurid, surreal, dismal glow like a bad lobster in a dark cellar, as Dickens put it about something else in the novelette I promised not to mention, A Christmas Carol. By way of example, a hard fact that decades ago lodged in my mind was the death toll of American military personnel in World War II. It was 286,000 GIs and sailors and airmen, or so that history book said. And that figure just took. It stuck in this mind. And now, of course, sometime in these last few weeks, the American death toll from this ghastly pandemic has pushed past that milestone. It is, of course, all too real, but also unreal. Real and unreal. You compound those two, you maybe get, well, surreal. And yet, this time of the year, you're not just looking back, you're also looking ahead. The new year. Famously, January, the first month in the new year, is named after Janus, the Roman god of beginnings and transitions. Doors, gates, that's where you'd find Janus. He's presiding over places of transition and transitional periods, from war to peace, for example. He always had two faces, old Janus. Two faces looking in opposite directions, one toward the past, the other toward the future. So yes, we're looking back, but also looking forward. And maybe more than at any other dying of the old year and coming in of the new year transition, in my lifetime at any rate, we're looking ahead to the new year with hope that's deeply felt and anything but casual. Hope that's tempered with serious trepidation, with some deep-down anxiety. Please God, that vaccine zaps the thing. All very different from last year's transition, the move from 2019 to 2020. I'm going to indulge myself and tell a personal story. A personal story that's like one of those color-changing gemstones. Alexandrites, I think they're called. Parts of it are funny, but then the funny curdled. Goes like this. Mary and I were in Malaysia last February and early March. Met our youngest son there. He lives in Chiang Mai in Thailand and came down to catch up with us at a Malaysian seaside resort. It was one of those holidays. And I think that was when COVID first got onto my personal radar screen. It was just a kind of minor green blip out on the edge. some sort of virus in a place in China I'd never heard of. Seemed like a local story. A bad forest fire the Chinese would get on top of, contain, put out. A long way from us. A long way from my life. But I can remember James, our son, joking that he wouldn't have any problem getting back into Thailand because Chinese tourism to Thailand had ground to a halt. And Chinese tourism is, well, was, hugely important to the Thai economy. They'd be rolling out the red carpet for every foreigner who was going to turn up on their doorstep. He was sure he'd be welcomed back with open arms. Well, how wrong he was. And the trouble he had getting past the immigration official wasn't a COVID matter. It was just a stiff-necked Thai immigration official. The point of the story was threefold. One, that he'd been very wrong about getting back in. Two, that the problem wasn't that viral outbreak in China. It was what James described as a real prick of an immigration officer. And three, what happened to him at Bangkok Airport was touch and go, but it did work out. And in fact, in the end, it proved to be very amusing. Some background. James is a breakdancer, a very good breakdancer. His mum, Mary, yes, Mary of London Walks, was a ballet dancer. Well, she still is. Still goes to 3 pros classes every week. And she was desperate to have one of her kids follow in her footsteps. Now, as you all know, the gods punish us by granting our wishes. So Mary got a dancer. She just didn't get what she thought she was going to get. She got a world-class breakdancer. Anyway, our breakdancer's son leaves Malaysia a day before we do, flies up to Bankers, absolutely convinced he's going to sail right in, and lo and behold, the uniform there is, as James put it, a real prick. Serious concentration. I thought they were going to put me on a plane and send me back to KL. The uniform says, "Why are you always in Thailand? Why are you in and out of Thailand always?" James said, I explained to him. I told him I'm a breakdancer. I'm flying out to competitions all over Asia. I don't believe you, breakdancer. James says, I can prove to you I'm a breakdancer. Let's just step outside and I'll show you. And that's what happened. I'm not sure what move it was that James put on him. I'd like to think it was his head spin whirly-twirly. James can spin on his head 32 times without his hands touching the floor once. But whatever it was, it worked. James said he instantly went through a 180-degree turn, became very friendly, said, "You welcome in Thailand. I see you breaking dancing in Thailand. I cheer for you," and let him in. That was all fun. Next day, we flew back to London. Plane landed. And they kept us on that plane for 4 hours. That was the moment for me. Some moment, it was a 4-hour-long moment at the end of a long flight. That was the moment the scales fell from my eyes. To paraphrase Yeats, some rough beast, its hour come round at last, was slouching toward the world to be born. And here we are, 9 months later, on the shortest, darkest day of the year, trying to take stock, looking back over this, yes, surreal year, wondering how can this have come about, and what's in store for us, trying to look into the seeds of time, see what's ahead. Phew. Yes, a steady diet of being reminded of that old Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. But let's get on to the Dickens. We've all developed our own strategies, reached into our own individual bags of tricks or resources, looking, each of us, I think, for one or more gyroscopes to help keep our emotional equilibrium. Find something positive, something enjoyable, something to hold on to, something to get our minds off it, some diversion. Professionally, and here I speak as a London Walks guide and indeed the London Walks couple, well, we as an organization of guides have turned our hand to these podcasts. This one is the 247th we've produced, and especially the virtual tours. There are now well over 200 London Walks virtual tours. So this terrible chapter in world history, this surreal time, has triggered the most tremendous creative outburst on the part of these gifted guides. It's, of course, been a financial disaster for guides and for London Walks. But put aside that admittedly important factor, we all have bills to pay, have to put food on the table and keep a roof over our heads. Put those pressing concerns aside, this plague year has in many other ways, creative ways, been astonishingly enriching. Guides have read widely, performed prodigies of picture research, created a brand new guiding form. Yes, a guiding form that did not exist before. A guiding form that has tremendous value and that will be in harness with normal guiding when it finally, we hope, resumes. That's the professional side. On the personal side, well, you'll have to speak to each individual guide about what they've done, the path they've carved out through the dark jungle of this surreal year. For me, well, it's probably no surprise. It's been tons of reading and research, and some of this, creating quite a few of these podcasts and a couple of virtual tours. And yes, getting out and walking London, and sometimes photographing it. The reading, well, this Tier 4 gave a final push, birthed something that's been coming for some time, namely rereading Dickens, all of Dickens. For about 2 decades after I did the PhD, I reread the complete works every 2 or 3 years. Then the kids came along and one thing and another, and of course, Dickens novels are doorstoppers. With a couple of exceptions, they're not quote-unquote normal-sized books. You're talking 800 pages. And yes, I've still got a lot on my plate, so I've not ratcheted back to my reread him every 2 years form. I'm not going to be able to give 3 hours a day to reading Dickens. It'll be an hour, one chapter every day. It'll take me about 3 years. But what fun it's going to be. I made my start last week, as soon as Tier 4 reared its ugly head. Instead of going through them chronologically, that was how I did it before, I'm going to flit and sip, do them in the order that I fancy. So sure enough, I started with my favorite Dickens novel, Our Mutual Friend, the last one that he completed. And just like that, a week on, I'm 7 chapters in, and what a ride, what a joy. He was a monster of a man, but what a writer. I'm going to illustrate that tonight with short passages from chapter 1 and chapter 4 and chapter 5. Our Mutual Friend opens with a hard, rough man and his daughter plying a little boat on the Thames between Southwark Bridge, which is of iron, and London Bridge, which is of stone, as Dickens puts it. The man, Gaffer Hexham, is a scavenger of corpses in the Thames, people who've drowned or been murdered and deep-sixed in the river. Not very far into the book, we get this short passage. And notice how carefully, how minutely, how exactingly observed it is. But notice as well something else. Notice the feel of the passage, in particular the rawness, the violence. You'll hear Dickens tell us the current is split and becomes a broad arrowhead. The paddles of the steamboat beat the filthy water. The logs of timber are lashed together. Gaffer Hexam's eyes dart. This man's a hunter. His world, his London, is a stark, unforgiving, violent place. Here's the passage. Trusting to the girl's skill and making no use of the rudder, he eyed the coming tide with an absorbed attention. So the girl eyed him. But it happened now that a slant of light from the setting sun glanced into the bottom of the boat, and touching a rotten stain there, which bore some resemblance to the outline of a muffled human form, colored it as though with diluted blood. This caught the girl's eye, and she shivered. "What ails you?" said the man, immediately aware of it, though so intent on the advancing waters. "I see nothing afloat." The red light was gone, the shutter was gone, and his gaze, which had come back to the boat for a moment, traveled away again. Wheresoever the strong tide met with an impediment, his gaze paused for an instant. At every mooring chain and rope, at every stationary boat or barge that split the current into a broad arrowhead, at the offsets from the piers of Southwark Bridge, at the paddles of the river steamboats as they beat the filthy water, at the floating logs of timber lashed together, lying off certain wharves, his shining eyes darted a hungry look. Gets into you, doesn't it? Gaffer is British slang for boss, and a gaff is a stick with a hook or barbed spear for landing large fish. Dickens gaffs us with his way with words here. We're there. We're hooked. Jumping ahead to chapter 4, we've got a meek little clerk, Reginald Wilfer. He's walking home after a day's work in the city. Again, notice how close, how fine, how precise the observation is. And also notice, again, how violent Reginald Wilfer's London is. The order of the day is things being burned, boiled, beaten, shot, etc. It's a savage, scary place, a jungle. R. Wilfer locked up his desk one evening and putting his bunch of keys in his pocket, much as if it were his peg top, made for home. His home was in the Holloway region north of London, and then divided from it by fields and trees. Between Battle Bridge and that part of the Holloway district in which he dwelt was a tract of suburban Sahara, where tiles and bricks were burnt, bones were boiled, carpets were beat, rubbish was shot, dogs were fought, and dust was heaped by contractors. Skirting the border of this desert, by the way he took, when the light of its kiln fires made lurid smears on the fog, R. Wilfer sighed and shook his head. "Ah me," said he, "what might have been is not what is." Reginald Wilfer gets home. Supper is served. The Wilfers are hard-pressed, but they just about manage to keep the wolf from the door. And after that long trek home, through that tract of suburban Sahara, well, Reginald's dinner, modest though it is, provides a crumb of comfort and warmth. A crumb of comfort and warmth, and a drop of comfort and warmth. Because there are two bottles on that little table. Dickens says, one held Scotch ale and the other rum. The latter perfume, with the fostering aid of boiling water and lemon peel, diffused itself throughout the room and became so highly concentrated around the warm fireside that the wind passing over the house roof must have rushed off charged with a delicious whiff of it, after buzzing like a great bee at that particular chimney pot. Pure descriptive genius. Everything is alive, fantastically, prismatically animated. Everything is personified. The wind blows, but it also sucks in a delicious whiff. And then, refreshed, animated, charged, in Dickens's word, it rushes off after buzzing like a great bee at that particular chimney pot. You're in the presence of a great writer, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody else in English Lit has this fecundity of imagination and facility of language, has, in one short phrase, vision with this sort of muzzle-loading velocity. Pretty much every sentence is a delicious whiff, the likes of which none of us has smelt before. Moving on, in Chapter 5, we meet one of my favorite characters, one Silas Wegg, a low-life scoundrel with a wooden leg, a street vendor who set up his grisly little stand near Cavendish Square. Wegg, the man with the wooden leg, is figuratively wooden all over, inside and out. And here we're on to something that sets Dickens apart from other writers. Everything is alive in his world, the inanimate as well as the animate. In fact, in many instances, the inanimate is more alive than the animate. And we notice as well that people partake of what's around them, what's to hand. They become like their furniture or their house, or in Wegg's case, like his wooden leg. So in this first short passage, the detail to focus on is that bit of pipe that Dickens brilliantly describes as being like a leech. But it's not just the pipe that's like a leech. Wegg, attaching himself to that corner house the way he has, taking ownership of it, as it were, is like a leech, is the passage. Over against a London house, a corner house not far from Cavendish Square, a man with a wooden leg had sat for some years with his remaining foot in a basket in cold weather. Over the house itself, he exercised the same imaginary power as over its inhabitants and their affairs. He had never been in it, the length of a piece of fat black water pipe, which trailed itself over the area door into a damp stone passage, and had rather the air of a leech on the house that had taken wonderfully. But this was no impediment to his arranging it according to a plan of his own. And then, further on, we get this description of Wegg himself. Wegg was a knotty man, and a close-grained, with a face carved out of very hard material that had just as much play of expression as a watchman's rattle. When he laughed, certain jerks occurred in it, and the rattle sprung. Sooth to say, he was so wooden a man that he seemed to have taken his wooden leg naturally, and rather suggested to the fanciful observer that he might be expected, if his development received no untimely check, to be completely set up with a pair of wooden legs in about 6 months. And finally, in Chapter 6, we get, first, the description of the six jolly fellowship porters, a downstream Thameside pub. It's a passage that takes wing. In all of English literature, There is no finer description of a London pub than this. The six jolly fellowship porters, already mentioned as a tavern of a dropsical appearance, had long settled down into a state of hale infirmity. In its whole constitution, it had not a straight floor and hardly a straight line, but it had outlasted and clearly would yet outlast many a better trimmed building, many a sprucer public house. Externally, it was a narrow, lopsided wooden jumble of corpulent windows, heaped one upon another as you might heap as many toppling oranges, with a crazy wooden veranda impending over the water. Indeed, the whole house, inclusive of the complaining flagstaff on the roof, impended over the water, but seemed to have got into the condition of a faint-hearted diver who has paused so long on the brink that he will never go in at all. This description applies to the river frontage of the six jolly fellowship porters. The back of the establishment, though the chief entrance was there, so contracted that it merely represented in its connection with the front the handle of a flat iron set upright on its broadest end. This handle stood at the bottom of a wilderness of court and alley, which wilderness pressed so hard and close upon the six jolly fellowship porters as to leave the hostelry not an inch of ground beyond its door. For this reason, in combination with the fact that the house was all but afloat at high water, when the porters had a family wash, the linen subjected to that operation might usually be seen drying on lines stretched across the reception rooms and bedchambers. The wood forming the chimney pieces, beams, partitions, floors, and doors of the six jolly fellowship porters seemed in its old age fraught with confused memories of its youth. In many places it had become gnarled and riven, according to the manner of old trees. Knots started out of it, and here and there it seemed to twist itself into some likeness of bows. In this state of second childhood, it had an air of being in its own way garrulous about its early life. Not without reason was it often asserted by the regular frequenters of the porters that when the light shone full upon the grain of certain panels, and particularly upon an old corner cupboard of walnut wood in the bar, you might trace little forests there, and tiny trees like the parent tree in full umbrageous leaf. But I'm more interested here in a lesser-known passage in the same chapter. We're back with Lizzie and her father, Gaffer, the fisher of men, the scavenger of Thames corpses. Gaffer's out hunting by himself. Lizzie's been home up all night. Dawn is just coming on. She goes out to the river to meet her returning father. This is just one sentence, a painterly descriptive sentence, a brilliant painterly descriptive sentence. The white face of the winter day came sluggishly on, veiled in a frosty mist, and the shadowy ships in the river slowly changed to black substances, and the sun, blood red on the eastern marshes behind dark masts and yards, seemed filled with the ruins of a forest it had set on fire. Now, all of these passages, all of these dishes I've set before you, have been primarily descriptive passages. But they're descriptive passages that also bring out character. The character of each individual player. Lizzie, her father Gaffer, Reginald Wilfer, the meek, rather sad little clerk, Silas Wegg, he of the wooden leg, etc. But these descriptive passages also, of course, bring out the character of the world these people inhabit, the character of London. And what I would suggest to you, finally, is that Dickens, uniquely, is the literary equivalent of six world-famous painters all rolled up into one. Those painters are Hogarth, Salvador Dali, Turner, Picasso, Monet, and Henri Rousseau. Hogarth, because of the detail of his observation and because he painted ordinary Londoners, poor Londoners, just as Dickens does. Picasso, because his vision is as genius and as bounding and as grotesque as Dickens's. Monet, because his paintings were all about color and light. And, well, I've given you here maybe 90, 100 lines of Dickens. 90, 100 lines suffused with color and light. Rousseau, well, think of those jungles and animals he painted. Everything is pulsing with life in them. Same goes for Dickens. Remember Maurice Sendak's extraordinary tale for children, Where the Wild Things Are. Dickens's world, his vision, his London, is an adult version of Where the Wild Things Are, a prose version of Rousseau's Tiger in a Tropical Storm. And Salvador Dali, well, Dali is surreal. Think of those melting clocks, for example, or his painting, Sleep. That's Dickens. Dickens is every bit as surreal as Dali. And finally, Turner. Let's reread the last Dickens passage I read. The break of day one. Lizzie Hexham has gone out to the river to meet her father, come back from his night's dredging for corpses. I'll remind you again, it's just one sentence. It's descriptive. It's Turner in words. If it were a painting, it would be a Turner. Goes like this. I defy anybody to hear this and not see a Turner painting. The white face of the winter day came sluggishly on, veiled in a frosty mist, and the shadowy ships in the river slowly changed to black substances, and the sun, blood red on the eastern marshes, behind dark masts and yards, seemed filled with the ruins of a forest it had set on fire. Dickens enough for you? Good night, everybody. Stay happy, Halls. Stay safe.